Wellness Radio with Deepak Chopra is kicking off a summer of stars. Summer of stars. Listen in all summer long as we talk about spirituality, success, health, and well-being with some of the biggest names in science, literature, and entertainment. Kicking it all off for the summer of 2010, entrepreneur Ray Chambers, singer Rachel Hollingsworth, performance artist Donna DeCruz, and Tom Silverman of Tommy Boy Records sit down to discuss the importance of music and education in America. The Summer of Stars with Deepak Chopra starts now.
I'm Deepak Chopra and this is Wellness Radio on the Sirius XM Stars channel, Sirius 102 and XM 155. On this program, we talk about spirituality, relationships, love, success, health and well-being, and of course our favorite topic, consciousness. I was hoping that my first guest would be the Pakistani political leader and humanitarian Imran Khan, also probably the most well-recognized face in Southeast Asia because of being an illustrious sportsman and cricketer, and we're still trying to get him. But with me in the studio is internet entrepreneur Bill Hoogterp, philanthropist and humanitarian Ray Chambers, who's been on the show before. TV and movie actress Rachel Hollingsworth, and hopefully in a little while, musical artist Donna DeCruz, who's also been on this show before. I want to ask Ray to lead this morning's conversation. Raymond Chambers, who's the special envoy of the Secretary General for Malaria, a friend of mine for the last many incarnations, and a philanthropist and a humanitarian who has directed most of his efforts towards children. He's the founding chairman of the Points of Light Foundation, co-founded with Colin Powell, America's Promise Alliance, and is also co-founder of the National Mentoring Partnership and founding chairman of both the Millennium Promise Alliance and Malaria No More. So it's great to have you, Ray, and I'm very grateful that you brought a very special friend of yours.
Happy to be here, Deepak.
And happy Valentine's Day, everyone. Happy Valentine's Day. It's all about love.
Yes.
So please, I've spent the last few minutes talking to Bill, and I've been totally overwhelmed. How long have you known Bill?
I've known Bill about 15 years. When I met him, he was heading an organization called COOL, Campus Outreach Opportunity League, and he had done a tremendous job turning that organization into a very positive entity and recruiting so many people in the college campus towards service and volunteerism. And as we were working on trying to rebuild the city of Newark, we thought that Bill could play a pivotal role in that effort. And my daughter Christine Gilfillan and I spent countless nights trying to persuade Bill to come to Newark.
Not true.
and he finally agreed. Our foundation gave him a grant of $100,000 and told him he could decide how much of a salary out of that he wanted to take and how much he would spend on helping the disadvantaged children of Newark in various programs. And he decided he would live at less than the poverty level, and he supplemented his income with a janitorial position at the Newark movie screens where the riots were in 1967 in Newark. He moved right into the heart of the most difficult drug-dealing area and felt he was protected by God and the goodness of what he was doing. And as I said to you before, Deepak, I've never met anybody so pure in motivation. And then he's gone on in the world to do things that have impacted children and people who engaged in volunteerism, unlike anybody else. And he's now playing a leading role in this whole service movement that was emblematic on January 19th, the day before the inauguration. And President Obama has ignited a fire of a desire for service, to give back, to help our fellow Americans, and Bill is in the forefront of that.
You know, my cousin Deepika actually worked for when Bill's organization, the internet company you started, right?
Yeah, we all worked for Deepika.
Yeah, you
know, Club Mom and yeah. Do Something. She's just fantastic.
Yeah, well, I'm definitely going to tell her I met you this morning. So, what drives you? What ignites this passion?
That's a very good question. First, I have to correct Ray on a couple of things. I think I was pitching him, not the other way around. And he offered long hours and low pay, and it's very difficult. If anybody knows how to say no to Ray Chambers, please teach me that trick. And you know, Newark's such an exciting place. So many good people there, so many good things happening. But to answer your question, Deepak, and thank you so much for having me on.
It's
I think, you know, it really started for me when I'm little. You know, whatever disorder they end up naming after Ray, maybe I have it too, but I got it from my parents. You know, the way my mom, who really came from a tough upbringing and always has a kind word for everybody. I remember my dad, we went to McDonald's once every few months, and we got home and he put the change on the counter, and he's so good with math, he instantly recognized he had $1 too much change given to him. So he drove back to McDonald's to return the dollar.
Oh my God.
And so growing up in that kind of a family, extended family, that if there's something wrong, you fix it. If people need help, you help mm-hmm. them. And then being the first one to go off to college and kind of go out in the world and travel, you just find there's a lot wrong mm-hmm. and there's a lot of help that's needed.
Mm. You know, they say that love without action is meaningless, and action without love is irrelevant.
Mm.
So it looks like, you know, you have that love in action going all the way. And, you know, we're going to talk to Rachel in a little while, but I was looking at some of the research that the Dalai Lama's Foundation has done recently on happiness. And they actually came up with a happiness formula after all the research. And they said happiness is a result of three things. Number one, apparently there's something called a brain set point for happiness in some people. And what differentiates the happy people from the unhappy people is that where unhappy people see problems, the happy people see opportunities. Mm. And this brain set point apparently is determined by upbringing, which is something, you know, Bill mentioned, his family. And partly is also genetic, but it can be changed through either meditation or through some forms of therapy called cognitive therapy, where people are actually taught to go beyond limiting belief systems. So that's the first component. Mm. And that apparently is about 40% or so of a person's so-called happiness quotient, whether they see problems or opportunities. The second component is called, you know, conditions of living. So it seems like this is a very minor component of happiness, conditions of living, including economic conditions mm-hmm. of living. It seems of the total happiness component, it's only about 7 to 8%. So people in Nigeria are happier, people in Puerto Rico are happier, people in Bhutan are happier, people in Mexico are happier, and people in places where there's extreme poverty are also happier mm-hmm. in some cases. Not all cases, mm-hmm. but in some cases. It seems like if you win the lottery today, let's say somebody wins $20 million, they'll be ecstatically happy, but if you look at them a year later, they're as happy or as unhappy as they were before they won the lottery. Some of them are unhappy now because they're worrying about the stock market. They didn't know what it was before. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they're worrying about what's happening to their stock, etc. If people have extreme tragedy, they get paralyzed, they lose a loved one, and it's remarkable how flexible human beings are. Within a year to 2 years, they'll be back to their original happiness score, even after a tragedy. Mm. So we have remarkable ways to adapt. This conditions of living component is only about 7 to 8%. Then there's a third component, which is the daily choices that we make. Mm. Okay, which is the major component of this whole happiness rating, about 55-60%. And the choices are divided into two kinds. One, it's all about me and it's all about pleasure, which gives transient happiness but doesn't give, you know, really permanent, meaningful happiness. And the other choices are, which are about other people, you know. The surest, fastest route to happiness is to make other people happy. So that was the happiness formula that they came up with. But, you know, we were with the Dalai Lama. And so we said, okay, let's say we, all of us, practice these simple things. Will we be happy? He said, you'll be happier, but you won't be happy in the sense of nirvana, you know, the ultimate experience of Buddhist thought. Because you'll still worry about old age, you'll still worry about sickness, you'll still worry about death. So somebody asked him, then, how do you get to that kind of happiness? And he says, when you experience within you that there's no such thing as a separate self. Mm. Okay? Only the separate self suffers. The transpersonal connected self will never suffer. And so, you know, I think it's one thing to know theory, but it's another thing to actually experience that kind of state of mind where you can be happy because of what you're doing, as, you know, Bill's just expressed. What is the... Can you talk a little bit about President Obama's call to action?
I can't speak for the White House, but I can tell you that a number of us are moved by his call, you know, a speech he had made in October about, you know, that service isn't just going to be a part, a program we do, a project we do on a day. It's going to be part of the fiber of what we want the administration to stand for. And the staff that we've interacted with really have that. You know, the day before the inaugural, they had over 1 million people, Buffy Wicks, people that organized this, all across the country doing service on Martin Luther King Day. And they've looked at how do we get everybody involved? And I'm an amateur student of history. I'm just a hack. But as I look at all the different movements, they usually have somebody at the top. You know, it's about Cesar Chavez, it's about Martin Luther King, et cetera. And my view is this is different. It, you know, the days of Superman are over, and it's time for the Justice League. It's time for to find the hero in all of us, that every single person, every kid, every boomer, everybody has that greatness and that beauty in them. How do we get it out? And the majority of people, only about a quarter of Americans really volunteer. And three quarters of them care. They want to do it. They're really moved by these things, but they don't know what to do. They have bad experiences. They don't know where to get started. And so for a number of us in conversations with them and across many other groups, it's, well, how do you get everybody else into the game? How do you help everybody else find that thing that, whether it's being a mentor or a coach or, but find something that really moves them. And that's the conversation that's going on right now.
Ray, you've been involved in mentoring for a long time, and that program really has taken off, hasn't it?
It really has. Back in 1991, when we began the Points of Light Foundation and the National Mentoring Partnership, we only had 300,000 mentors in the country. We now have 5 million. Not only has it affected the lives of youngsters at risk, it's caused 5 million people to derive greater satisfaction in their lives and from this effort. And as you were speaking about the quotient of happiness, I was thinking that most of us will never get to that point where we recognize that we are not a separate self. Mm-hmm. We can aspire to that. But if 50 to 60% of the happiness quotient is what Bill is talking about by being in service to others, whether it's by sending $10 into Malaria No More to buy a bed net to save a child's life, or it's to become a mentor, or it's to work in a soup kitchen, or even with your Alliance for a New Humanity, just by taking the vow of no violence in your thinking, haven't we taken a step toward garnering a piece of that 60% that would lead us toward happiness? And I'm sensing throughout the world, and certainly President Obama's call has been impactful, that there's a feeling of movement, a desire by people to want to give back, to help somebody else. And I think the economic debacle is actually pushing people more in that direction, as opposed to in the direction of being more selfish and self-centered. And I know in companies like Federal Express, and I heard about the Metropolitan Opera the other day, they gave the employees an option to take a pay cut of 5 or 10% and keep all their fellow employees employed, rather than reducing the workforce by 5 or 10%. And the employees voted just about unanimously to sacrifice a bit themselves to help their fellow employees. And do you sense we're seeing a certain shift in spirit?
Yeah, and as you said, the economic debacle is kind of came about as a result of selfishness, greed, power mongering, cronyism, influence peddling, and all the things that, you know, are so unnatural to us as human beings. But we created an environment where that almost became glamorous, you know, to have huge bonuses, to drive fancy cars, to live extravagantly and lavishly and display that more than anything else. And we are recognizing the total hollowness and the emptiness of that. And as we see people suffering and share in their suffering, this experience that spiritual traditions call compassion is born. And when there is compassion, there is love, there is healing. And it's the most powerful force in the world. And, you know, I was reading recently some interesting scientific research that if you look at, say, a television program where Mother Teresa is kissing children with leprosy, even though it's not a very pleasant sight, there's a phenomenon called mirror neurons. Your neurons start to experience what she's experiencing. So she's experiencing love and compassion. Just by watching that, your neurons start to mirror that activity, and you start to experience that. And suddenly your IgE levels, which is an antibody in your blood, which helps you fight cancer and infections, your IgE levels, which can easily be measured in the saliva. You know, so you just take a little bit of saliva and you see IgE levels before you watch Mother Teresa and then after you watch her, and you suddenly start getting healthier, physically healthier. Your immune system goes up. There are peptides called, you know, there are immunomodulators called dopamine and serotonin and oxytocin and opiates, which make you feel happy, but they also fine-tune your immune system. So, you know, just watching somebody doing an act of service or love in action will make you a healthier, happier person. Well,
I think you just came up with a new slogan for a campaign. Do service, it helps you drool better.
Yeah, and then your drooling has lots of antibodies.
I forgot to warn you about that part of Bill.
Yeah. I was polite for 2 whole minutes, so.
No, but... you know, this is all very interesting to know that, you know, Mahatma Gandhi used to say, you have to be the change you want to see in the world. And if I can be that change and just be that change, then people in my environment, because of this phenomenon of mirror neurons, which is apparently this is how we learn everything. So, you know, a baby monkey watching his mother eating a banana, the same parts of brain will go active which are involved in eating the banana. So much of our learning is through this phenomenon called mirror neurons, which is actually part of this mentoring process also. Very little of our learning is actually rational learning through books or whatever, even though we spend all our resources in that. The best way to teach somebody is just to be that.
Deepak, going back to the cause of the economic debacle, self-centeredness, greed, my observations have been, even of myself, when I was involved in business, that we grow up being exposed to lavish lifestyles, lifestyles of the rich and famous and power and celebrity. And maybe it's by those mirror neurons
yeah.
that we aspire to do that. Mm-hmm. And that perhaps some of these business leaders who are now being criticized wanted to take that as far as they could take that, the way a competitive athlete would mm-hmm. like to set the record or win the championship. Mm-hmm. And what would your response be to a question that if the best business leader, the best entrepreneur won the contest by being the wealthiest, by being the most successful, having the most lifestyles of the rich and famous toys, would they be getting closer to happiness or making that void even greater?
Much greater, of course, much greater. And there's no meaning or purpose in that kind of lifestyle. You know, there's lack of meaning. And one of the things that we hunger for as human beings is meaning in our lives. And, you know, the recent spate of philanthropy, of course, you've been doing this for many years, but with Bill Gates and Warren Buffett getting involved, has inspired a lot of people, actually. And as you also know, that, you know, Muhammad Yunus and the Grameen Bank and, you know, micro-lending and how powerful that has been. And I was telling Bill about some of the alliances that have been forged actually through the Alliance for the New Humanity in putting together people with a common vision to improve economic conditions through just partnering. We had these indigenous Guatemalan women, and we had this rum manufacturer in Guatemala who used to export bottles of rum, and we convinced him to use these bottles in packages made by these women who were weaving baskets, attractive looking baskets from some indigenous plant that grows there, some kind of straw. And they went from making 25 baskets a week to 25,000 baskets a week. The children started to go to school, AIDS came down, the women took leadership roles, and the whole demographic of that area changed just as a result of this alliance. We had another woman from Rwanda whose family was murdered in the genocide there. She went to law school and defended the murderers of her family and started a movement of forgiveness. And she's a national hero now, and she's 24 years old, and she's a national hero in Rwanda, and it's spreading across the other countries, neighboring countries, a whole movement of forgiveness, understanding that violence also has a context. It comes from, violence comes from an economic context of extreme poverty, extreme subjugation, history of slavery, and so many things that we don't recognize. You know, people are not naturally violent. Violence also comes as a result of those mirror neurons, you know, which is what happens in these countries. We had a counterterrorism expert here last week, and he was saying, you will never be able to win a war on terrorism by killing terrorists, because terrorism is the result of an ideology that is born in abject poverty, extreme abuse, religious fundamentalism that comes as a result of disempowerment, disenfranchisement. You know, these people who are there are either extremely poor or they have been dispossessed. You know, in the West, the Muslim boys in the ghettos, they have been ghettoized. Mm-hmm. So he said there'll never be a military solution to terrorism. And I was so happy to see Mr. Obama, our president, said the other day we should get rid of the expression war on terrorism and then find creative solutions to this. And it spoke to my heart when he said that, because, as you know, we've been talking about that for a long time. Bill, what's the organization through which you...
Right now I'm doing something called The League, theleague.org, and our focus is to get all the kids in the country and in the world hooked on doing good early in life. And as we're talking to them, we find that examples like Mother Teresa are inspiring, but in some ways so inspiring, they're on a pedestal, they're awe-inspiring. Mm-hmm. And the most powerful examples for them are their peers, mm-hmm. you know, they can relate to. I think most of us are actually taught by our peers, just like we hunt in packs and we grow in spurts. And my aha moment when I was a college student that really drives some of our design is that I volunteered. I was a service nerd, volunteered an hour a day, but I hit a lot of other things in my life. And I did an hour a day at the soup kitchen as the janitor. And I don't know why I like to do it, talk to the guys and mop the floors that I just did. And I couldn't get any of my friends to do it. And I tried, and I was striking out. And I finally got mad at my friend Brian, who was just the nicest guy in the world, but he didn't do anything like this. I said, "You're such a good person, you have to do this." And he was a catcher on the baseball team. I was on the track team. And he said, "You know what I always wanted to do was something with juvenile delinquents." He said, "I know you're not supposed to call them that, but something about those kids really kind of touches me. And I'm so bright, I spent two more months trying to make him do my soup kitchen thing. I finally gave up. And we found a program about a mile from campus where kids were in trouble with the law. And Brian went and he played ping pong with the kids for 2 hours. And he liked it so much, he went back every Saturday for a year and he got five friends to go with him. And I realized, and Ray improved this for me yesterday, but I realized then that there's actually 37 issues in society total. And I put them all in a big circle. And all of us, whether it's literacy or AIDS or environment or seniors, all of us are drawn, in fact, have an irrational commitment to at least one of those for reasons we may not understand.
There's a passion.
There's a passion, and it's within. And I put them all in a circle. And then I put a circle next to it, slightly overlapping, of what you like to do for fun. Reading, gardening, sports, music, what have you. And the third circle intersecting them underneath of who you like to hang out with. And when the three circles intersected, it was magic. For my friend Brian, hanging out with his buddies on a Saturday morning for a couple hours playing ping pong with these kids became a part of his life. He didn't need to be guilted or incented. It was like he discovered a room in his house he never knew that he had, and he was, as you described, a happier, healthier person, and he's influencing his peers. For so many people, service is a little bit ascetic. It's, I should be more like that. I wish I could deprive myself and go do something I know I'm not going to enjoy. We feel guilty of all the things we don't do more of because we haven't found the thing that triggers those mirror neurons in us.
That's very interesting. Name some of these 37.
Well, Ray said it's too many. And when we met with Arnie Duncan last week, it's too many. So Ray said, and Ray's right, and I hate to admit that publicly on the air, it's 10, you know, if you think about education, health, et cetera. But if you take education, for example, as one of the 10, underneath it, there's three or four natural subgroups like pre-K or K-12 or college or adult education. So you take the 27 under the 10. But the why we are drawn to certain things, and I did a tour of lots of colleges speaking, and I found there's actually no such thing as an apathetic person. Everybody cares, but most people don't act on what they care about. And as Ray said, they may have tried and had a bad experience, or they don't know where to get started, or for whatever reason, it hasn't clicked.
It's fascinating because it comes... Okay, we'll be right back. We're going to take a break right now.
Welcome back to Wellness Radio's Summer of Stars Kickoff with your host, Deepak Chopra.
I'm Deepak Chopra, and we are back now in our conversation with my very illustrious guests, philanthropist Ray Chambers and internet entrepreneur, humanitarian Bill Hoogterp. And, you know, we have Ray's son-in-law, Marcel, in the studio, and he said, you talked about, you know, when you watch Mother Teresa and your antibodies go up, what happens if you're having the opposite experience? What happens when you're watching, say, Hitler or violence? And what happens is that your immune system goes into total chaos. We were also talking earlier about mirror neurons, and here's something very interesting that people are discovering. You know, we've always said love is a powerful healing force, but always thought of it as metaphorical. It turns out that when a baby is born, the baby's self-repair mechanisms are not mature, you know, because the baby is, when after 9 months of being in the womb, when the baby comes out into this world, the baby's self-repair mechanisms, which in medical terminology we call it homeostasis, self-repair, self-regulation. So there are thousands of these little thermostats that regulate your blood pressure, your immune system, your body temperature, your hormone levels, etc., etc. So a lot, you know, these finely tuned self-regulating mechanisms. And during the first 3 years, these mature as a result of a baby's experience of love. And the baby watches, again, mirror neurons, but, you know, watches eye movements, voice tone, gestures, cooing, cuddling, kissing. These are the experiences that cause the immune system and all these self-regulators to mature. If the baby doesn't experience that, the baby will be physically and emotionally retarded in terms of self-repair, and ultimately will become a violent person. And, you know, all the violence in the world is a result of the baby not having received that love. As adults, the same thing happens to us. If we suffer lack of love, separation, you know, divorce, things like that, or we lose a spouse or whatever, the death rate of people is something 5 to 20 times higher as a result of feeling lack of love. If a person then experiences love again, there's a phenomenon, again, mirror neurons, and it's called limbic resonance, where the person starts to self-regulate, and given enough love, doesn't matter what the disease is, the self-regulatory mechanisms will kick in and then help you to get rid of the specific disease. So, you know, we've always been confused in medicine. You know, two people get the same treatment, they have the same illness, they get the same chemotherapy, they see the same physician, and they have completely different outcomes. You know, this person dies, this person recovers, and more it's being discovered that it is the experience of love, gestures, just saying, if a nurse calls a patient up after a heart attack on the phone and says, Mr. Smith, we're thinking of you. 6 weeks after they've had a heart attack, they call the phone, 30 seconds, we're thinking of you, know that we love you, we care about you. The death rate from heart attack goes down by 50%. Now, if there was a drug that did that and you didn't use it, you would be sued for malpractice. You know, you would be sued for malpractice. But yet, you know, this is more powerful than any drug you can think of. And thank God this kind of research is coming out right now. So, you know, societies that are relational, you know, in Cuba, for example, people are happier. I once asked my Cuban hostess, how come people are so happy here? He says, because we're not a consumer society, we're a relationship society. You know, we don't have much to buy, so we focus on relationships and we're happy. So I want to come back, though, to your to your organization. I think people should know about it because we are in the midst of a movement right now in this country and hopefully globally.
How come every time you talk about the beautiful aspects of society and personality, you look at Ray, and then when you say all the problems in the world, you turn and look at me?
Well, you know, Ray needs a little bit of ego gratification.
I was missing that love.
Well, the good news is, and I think the President, First Lady get a lot of credit, but there's something in the air, and there's so many leaders like, Alan Casey, Michelle Nunn, John Bridgeland, Anne-Marie Connolly, Michael Brown came together to create something called Service Nation, that 100 different organizations joined to say, there's so many good people promoting service in different ways on the national level, state, local level, and both presidential candidates, and Senator McCain also really cares about service and approaches it from a couple different angles, but it's really in his heart. They came together and spoke on 9/11 in New York, and many corporate leaders, governors, and so forth came. A woman named Lisa Paulson, who's from the Entertainment Industry Foundation, you may know last year she did something called Stand Up to Cancer, and it galvanized so many people. And there's just powerful leaders from all walks of life who have said, you know, this is really true in my own life, because everybody's involved in different things, and they've discovered what we're talking about in their own life, but gosh, how do we make it scalable? How do we bring it, get the little ones doing it, as we're trying to do in the league? How do we get boomers doing it? The AARP has become very engaged in the conversation. They told us that we have the same experience that the kids do, because when we're successful getting kids to go volunteer, we often send lemmings off the cliff. They show up at agencies that don't either want them or don't really know what to do with them. And the seniors have often the same experience. They really want to make a difference, formally, informally, structured, unstructured. And we all have been there where you want to serve soup and you're out there, but you really only need 4 people on the line and you got 7 people standing around. And the efforts of the people running that soup kitchen are admirable. Everybody knows how many hours they're putting in. But my theory is that we've got to bring some structure to the system. Every successful sector, whether it's entertainment, as Ray is from, or politics, or business, or sports, or internet, has developed its infrastructure, its systems, leadership training systems, web portals, etc. And the service movement, the philanthropy sector, the charity world really hasn't done as much of that as we need to. It wasn't really designed to solve problems. It was designed to help build barns and make quilts and feed people who were only going to be out of work for a short period of time, and these were temporary problems. So there's a lot in the air right now about people from all walks of life saying, how do we bring service to the forefront?
And everyone who's listening right now, you know, with something that Bill said earlier, is that no matter who you are, there's one thing that will evoke a passion inside you. And if you put that to use in service, you will be really very much a happier person. And I remember when you were speaking about that, you know, I trained to be a doctor, but I realized that seeing patients did not make me as happy as teaching medical students. Mm-hmm. And that is what sparked my entire career, you know. So even though I was training to be a doctor to actually teach, to see patients, the greater joy came from teaching medical students. So that was the education factor, one of the things that people get passionate about. I want our audience to know how they can get involved in what you're doing, Bill.
Well, theleague.org is our website, and you can learn about what we're doing with students K-12. We've got over 100,000 students involved in the year since we've launched, and there's many, many other great organizations out there. So you just Google service and what it is that you really care about. Mm-hmm. You know, what really moves you, even if you don't know
We'd
why.
We'd like to collaborate with you, you know, because our 3 goals with the Alliance for the New Humanity, and that, by the way, is www.anh.org, anh.org, and, of course, our ancillary site, itakethevow.com. And we have 3 components, by the way, to our activities. Number 1 is be the change you want to see in the world. Number 2 is service, whatever you're passionate about. And number 3 is conversation. Let's share our stories, because there's nothing more inspiring than a story of transformation, something that made a difference. And if that story is true, then, you know, but there's nothing more powerful than that. And so we're trying to change the collective conversation, as we're trying to do right now on this radio, which brings me, so check it out, theleague.org, theleague.org, mm-hmm. okay, theleague.org, and anhglobal.org. So my next guest is an actress, her name is Rachel Hollingsworth, and I met her actually at a very interesting event in Washington that was run by Bill Cohen, our former Secretary of Defense, who said that who was doing an event on race and reconciliation. Mm-hmm. So Rachel is African American. She's extraordinarily beautiful, which you can't see her right now, but
you
can sense her energy, I'm sure. So tell me what happened after that conference. You know, it was very interesting because you came to a course also.
Mm-hmm. So I'm a singer and an actress, and I live in Hollywood. And as we're talking about before, with the mirror neurons, you know, I come from immigrant parents from Jamaica, from the ghetto. And it was all about the fame and the fortune of Hollywood. Ooh, the big illusion. And I reached a, you know, a place in my career where I was very, very, very unhappy. And I met Deepak, and he invited me at, you know, at the Race Forum. And he invited me to his Seduction of Spirit course retreat where I sang. And it totally changed my life. And at the end of the course, he asked me, well, what's next for you? And I said, I actually don't know. So he gave me an assignment to be silent and to meditate 2 times a day, an hour each, for 3 weeks. And I did it. And at the end of it, what came to me was happiness. What is happiness? And why am I so unhappy when I have everything? How do I find happiness? And I remember when I went to Dakar, Senegal 4 years ago, that I was amongst children working in the in a organization called Village SOS, where I was volunteering, song and dance, my passion. I took it into service, and the kids there were so happy. So I said, I'm going to go back to Dakar, Senegal. So Deepak said, you have to meet Ray Chambers. And I sat with Ray Chambers for 3 hours at this fabulous dinner, and I said to him, you know, I really, while I'm there in Dakar, Senegal, want to go and be of service. So he said, you must visit Millennium Village Project, Millennium Promise. And I went in to the poorest places in Dakar, in Senegal, actually, because this is 3 hours outside of Dakar, and was amongst people who were so happy. And I found, in accordance with Bill, that happiness comes in two forms, through an artistic form of expression. What is your happiness? What is your passion? What moves you? What makes you want to get out of bed? And make that intertwine with service, to be of service, to help others, to give back. And that is what happiness is all about. And my project is called Ça Va, which in French, of course, is It Is Well. So I'm going to make it into
In Hindi, it is Ça Va, same thing.
Really?
Yes.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
So I'm going to make the catchphrase, all is happy, and it's just all about being happy. And I think the reason why people, I would love to go all over the world, India, Israel, Brazil, Australia, the rainforest, the Amazon, where people are amongst despair, and see how they're happy and why they're happy. And I found in Dakar, Senegal, people are happy because of their sense of community. Life is simple. There's no bling bling. There's no, you know, BMW. There's no mansion. It's just simple song and dance and community. And that's what it's about. Simplicity, happiness. What's the passion and how do we put it into service? And there were poor people being of service unto other poor people. So there was this volunteer group called L'Empire des Enfants, where they work with children who are trafficked off of the street. So these women in Africa don't have a lot of money, and they're housing these children, they're feeding these children, and they're educating these children. And that is what happiness to me is all about. So I want to use my entertainment media experience and do a show where I can show America that we have everything. And places where they have nothing, they're still happy, they're still of service, they're still giving back. And to bring it to the TVs of mid-America, from California to New York, and for them to see examples of people all over the world giving back through their passion.
Mm. You see, we're talking about artistic expression exactly. also. And, you know, one of the things I noticed in Cuba, by the way, was that there were street poets, mm-hmm. street minstrels, you know, the kind of troubadours that were entertaining on the streets. There were grandparents and grandchildren playing chess on the streets, you know, using the pavement as the chessboard. I went to a restaurant and the waitresses would dance with the customers after serving them. It was so celebrative. The whole thing was so celebrative. We've lost the joy yes. of celebration here. Mm-hmm. People are so serious. Mm-hmm. There's no play. And, you know, service is a drudgery mm-hmm. and in many cases. Work is drudgery. Everybody's in a hurry. You know, what is this life? We have no time to stand and stare. That kind of tragedy that has happened. And maybe the economic meltdown will bring us to mm-hmm. what the real priorities of life are.
I think this is why it's so, I'm sorry, Ray. I think this is why it's so important, happiness, because we in America are experiencing right now the bailouts and the recession and a lot of, you know, husbands are losing their jobs. So housewives are now saying, I love to cook. How could I, you know, take this passion and be of service? Maybe I can cook for a homeless shelter. Maybe I can go to Africa and teach other people how to cook. Who knows? But I really think this is something that is necessary. I think it's a form of cleansing. And I think it's going to bring about a lot of ways and a lot of forms that people can be happy through service.
I was going to ask, after listening to Rachel and Bill speaking about something in the air and the economic meltdown, as you just termed it, do you see what's happening to us? Because it is so painful. It is so unprecedented in size. And we lost 575,000 jobs in January in our country. Do you see this once in our lifetime economic meltdown being a catalyst for a change in the paradigm that we would think about service to others, getting back to simplicity and basics, as opposed to the trend we've been on for decades?
Which was almost vulgar, actually, in hindsight. The extravagance with mm-hmm. which people displayed their wealth was the ultimate in vulgarity. We are being forced to recognize mm-hmm. that we are one economy, globally. We are being forced to recognize that we are one ecology globally. Mm-hmm. We are now being forced to recognize that we are one humanity mm-hmm. globally. And we have a president who's kind of symbolically a representation of that. You know, is he Muslim? Is mm-hmm. he Christian? His father came from, you know, this little mm-hmm. village, was a potato farmer. He grew up in Indonesia. He was born in Hawaii, ended up in Harvard. He in many ways transcends religious identity, racial identity. He's not black. He's a man of color, which, by the way, you know, majority of the world is colored. So he transcends racial identity. He transcends religious identity. And may I dare say, he transcends national identity. He's being seen as a global leader across the world. So if it has a lot to say about our collective consciousness mm-hmm. that because he's the symbolic representation of the death of an old paradigm and the resurrection of something that's new, that's really a leap in our collective consciousness. And so we have a few minutes left and, you know, I'd love to welcome my next guest, who's also the producer of the great Rumi albums that we have produced, the ultimate embodiment of love. And I think I'd like to close with The Intoxication of Love, which is track number 26, by the way, on our CD. And, you know, we have in many cases discounted the importance of the artistic expression of love, whether it's through poetry, mm-hmm. through music, mm-hmm. through drama. That in fact, this year, by the way, the Alliance theme is going to be the arts and personal and social and planetary transformation. And we're going to do it in San Diego. I'm getting help from people like Sandy Gallen and David Geffen and other people. It's going to be an extraordinary. And the Lincoln Center for the Performing Arts is actually co-sponsoring the Alliance meeting this year. And now I'm thrilled to meet Bill, and with Ray's help, this is going to be extraordinary. We are definitely reaching that critical mass. So, Donna, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Deepak. Thanks. Nice to be here and be a part of it. The energy is so exciting, yeah. Not just in here, but, you know, based on what we're talking about, we're going to be, it's funny, you know, we have oftentimes put our art or put our philanthropy, put our service into the we'll do when we have spare time or we'll address when we have spare money. And I think the reality of this new paradigm is it's now. As we're saying, there has never been a time where we have felt more connected and felt the interconnectedness of all beings at all levels, no matter who you are. So I've had to make choices in my life for a long time about how I want to invite joy, purpose, passion, and peace. And, we have the joy of doing it through music. You know, you look at someone like Rumi, who is the sweet face of Islam, and he has, with such beautiful, transcendental ideas, just invited us to look at ourselves differently, to dance a different dance. And I think it's time for that. It's kind of over time for that. But then we can feel that acceleration. It's exciting. We're asking ourselves, am I doing what I love? Am I in service? What else could I be doing? And I thought that was so brilliant the day before. On the 19th of January, we saw Obama painting a wall, you know, a very bright blue wall, and asking, you know, the young folks were standing around asking, well, you know, what exactly are we doing here? And he was saying, it's about asking yourself those questions. If I'm a bus driver, what else could I be doing in that role, in that service? So it's not even about, you know, looking for something that's, where someone needs help particularly, but saying, I just want to do better for myself, for my family, for myself as an individual. What more can I give? Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that's what's very exciting. That's what we're doing every day. I get to play music for people who have had very privileged lives and who come there and, you know, wonder, well, what else is there? And I think that maybe they're not really just asking what else is there for me. We're all saying what else is there for all of us. And now it's actually getting fun, but it's a good idea to bring joy into it.
Exactly. And joy and love and service are actually the same thing. You see, when you think of work, you think of drudgery. But when you think of service, you're automatically sparked by love.
As wealth and money are devalued, relationships become more valued. Right, so we're going for the gross national happiness to go up.
No, we are understanding. No,
I like that.
But we are also understanding the difference between money and wealth, because money is just a symbolic expression of what we value. And as our values change, we will have true wealth consciousness. Well, we're running out of time. So here's something I'd like to, you know, a quote came to mind, a biblical quote from the days of King Solomon, which, of course, Donna and I have shared this, but it's not part of the traditional Bible. Somebody sent it to me. It was part of the findings in the Egyptian desert, you know, when they found these Essene writings. And whoever this ancient poet is, he's speaking to God, and he says, "You split me and you tore my heart open and you filled me with love. You poured your spirit into mine. I knew you as I know myself. My eyes are radiant with your light. My ears delight in your music, and my nostrils are filled with your fragrance. You have made me see all things new. You have made me see all things shining. You have granted me perfect ease. I have become like paradise. And having become like paradise, my soul is healed." I think we have seen a rift in our collective soul. Mm. And now that rift in our collective soul is going to be healed, because we're coming from a different place in our collective consciousness. And just in the last 3 minutes, I want to play to you this beautiful poem from Rumi. It's called The Intoxication of Love. Donna De Cruz is the producer of this. We have an African-American poet who's reciting this. And there's Iranian lyrics in the background. This is where we're going. This is our future.
Oh, long for your love. Oh, supreme lover, let me leave aside my worries. The flowers are blooming with the exaltation of your spirit. By Allah, I long to escape the prison of my ego and lose myself in the mountains.
I'm Deepak Chopra, so stay tuned in. This is going to be followed by dialogues by myself and another person in the next hour, and then we'll be repeating this program right till tomorrow morning. So keep your feet on the ground, keep reaching for the stars, and stay connected. I'm Deepak Chopra, and I'll see you next Saturday.
These towns not finding what they seek. You are the essence of the essence, the intoxication of love.